Welcome to the debate. Usually, you know, when we talk about fixing a broken system, there's this expectation of mechanical precision.
Right. It's like looking at a car engine.
Exactly. The engine is knocking, you run a diagnostic, you identify the faulty spark plug, you swap it out, and the mechanic points to the smoothly running motor and says, there it is, fixed.
Yeah, it's a very clean binary operation. I mean, the machine was broken, a specific component was replaced, and now, well, the machine is repaired.
And that framing is deeply comforting to us. We love problems that can be isolated, quantified, and solved from the outside with, you know, the right set of tools.
But then you step out of the garage.
Right. You step into the reality of ecological collapse, social fragmentation, public health crises, and suddenly that mechanics toolkit is completely useless. We are looking at a living, breathing landscape that is messy, intertwined, and fundamentally rejects being treated like a machine.
It is the absolute definition of a complex system. It's the kind of environment where applying a targeted mechanical cure can actually hide or even exacerbate the underlying disease.
Exactly. So today we are diving into a profound shift in how we approach human survival and flourishing. Specifically, the transition from this mechanistic crisis management approach to society toward a truly regenerative model.
And we're grounding this discussion in the academic white paper From Regenerative Cultures to Life Coherent Bioregioning by Dr. Bishara Saheli, which, by the way, is a rigorous engagement with the pioneering work of Daniel Christian Wall.
It is. And at the heart of our discussion today is a pivotal disagreement about how that transition to a regenerative society actually happens.
Right. The core question is, to build truly just and sustainable societies, is it enough to adopt a localized, relational, and process-oriented regenerative mindset?
Or, on the flip side, does this relational approach fundamentally fail without strict, explicit normative criteria and structured multiscalar governance? Because otherwise, you know, you might not prevent institutional capture and displaced harm.
So, for our listeners, I represent the perspective that relationality and resilience are normatively insufficient on their own. I mean, without the explicit life coherence criterion and nested regenerative governance, we will completely fail to prevent harmful systems from simply adapting their PR and externalizing their costs onto the vulnerable.
And I represent the perspective that regeneration must be an organic, place-based process. It has to be grounded in living questions and relationality, because overly rigid, top-down frameworks inevitably recreate the exact detached managerialism they are seeking to escape.
Well, I'm sure we'll have plenty to say about that.
Oh, definitely. Let me start by laying out why the foundational shift Wall and Saheli describe is so critical. For centuries, our institutions have operated under that crisis management frame we just talked about.
The mechanic with the wrench.
Right. We identify a bounded problem, we abstract it from its context, and we impose an external solution. But humanity does not stand outside of nature holding a wrench. We are entirely embedded in it.
I agree with the diagnosis of the problem, certainly.
Good, because we have to shift from being external managers to engaging in what the paper calls reflexive participation within living systems, because life is an organized relational continuity. It's a continuous process.
Right. We cannot engineer life.
Exactly. Daniel Christian Wall talks about bioregioning as a verb. It is a practice of asking living questions, local, place-responsive practice, where communities discover their own unique biocultural regenerative expressions.
But see, this is where I think that approach falls short.
How so? It's the only way we avoid the paternalism of universal top-down solutions that historically just crush local context. You cannot mandate regeneration from a global headquarters.
I come at it from a different way. Moving past the crisis management machine model is necessary, yes, but relying on a purely relational and process-based orientation is frankly dangerously incomplete.
Dangerously incomplete?
Yes, because we have to understand that a system can be highly relational, incredibly resilient, and deeply embedded in the local place while remaining profoundly unjust.
Wait, but if it's truly regenerative and relational, how could it be unjust?
Think of an exploitative labor arrangement, like a company town, or a deeply patriarchal institution. I mean, the people in those systems are highly related to one another.
Well, sure, in a structural sense.
And the systems themselves are incredibly resilient. They survive for generations. They adapt to local ecologies perfectly. That is why we must introduce what Saley calls the life coherence criterion.
Which is what exactly, in practical terms?
It's the explicit principle that an arrangement is only life coherent if it protects or enlarges living capacities without securing those gains through avoidable disablement elsewhere.
Okay, so a do-no-harm baseline.
More than that. Without this explicit, normative boundary, regenerative just becomes a meaningless branding tool. It's a buzzword for institutions that continue to hide their true costs.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on why imposing those strict, normative criteria from the top down misses the biological reality of how systems actually change.
Okay, I'm listening.
When we talk about life, we have to talk about the biological concept of autopoiesis.
Meaning the way a living cell continually produces and maintains its own organization?
Precisely. Living systems respond according to their own internal structure and their own history. This is known in the literature as structural coupling. If you perturb a living system, it doesn't just passively absorb your external command.
Right, it reacts.
It absorbs, resists, or redirects that command based on what it already is. Let's say a centralized government imposes a strict new life coherence criterion policy on a rural farming community. The community doesn't just become a perfect reflection of that policy.
Well, they have to comply with the law.
But they adapt it to their existing culture. They find loopholes or they reject it entirely. Imposing these criteria is like trying to build a living cell from the outside by forcing chemical components together with tweezers. It completely ignores the self-producing, autonomous nature of the community. Justice has to emerge organically from the relationships within the system.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that.
You don't think communities are autonomous?
Well, let me tell you why. The biological analogy is useful for understanding complexity, sure. But it breaks down completely when we apply it to human institutions as a justification for organic emergence. Organizations and institutions are not literal biological cells.
They behave like organisms, though. I mean, they fight for survival. They lock into path dependencies.
They do, but they do not possess cellular metabolism. The concept of autopoiesis applied to a corporation or a municipality is strictly a metaphor.
A powerful metaphor, though.
But a biological cell cannot deliberate about justice. A cell does not hold a board meeting and decide to externalize its waste into the neighboring tissue to boost its quarterly energy metrics.
Well, cancer cells sort of do.
But without intent. The persons acting within a government or a corporation absolutely do deliberate. They interpret, they make choices, and they can be held accountable. When we look at why degeneration persists in our world, it is not just innocent biological structural coupling. It is institutional self-maintenance driven by power and intentional design.
So you are saying that institutions actively choose to be degenerative even when they adopt regenerative language.
Yes, and they do it through a mechanism called selective visibility. They set accounting boundaries that intentionally hide what Vall identifies as the invisible regenerative economy.
Okay, give me an example. Let's ground this.
Sure, think about a massive corporate hospital system. On paper, their accounting shows incredible efficiency. They're turning over beds quickly, their margins are great, and they might even have, you know, solar panels on the roof and call themselves regenerative.
Okay, sounds good so far.
But what is missing from their ledger?
Ah, the aftercare. What happens when the patient goes home?
Exactly. The family members who are now doing 40 hours of unpaid care at home because the patient was discharged early to save the hospital money.
Right, shifting the burden.
The institution looks resilient and highly efficient, but only because it is externalizing its true costs onto exhausted households and the social fabric. That is selective visibility.
It's a classic externalization of costs.
And if you don't have an explicit structural life coherence criterion demanding that we look at that avoidable disablement elsewhere, like the burnout of those family members, these institutions will just adapt to the new regenerative vocabulary while keeping their extractive accounting boundaries perfectly intact.
That is a powerful example, I'll admit. And I completely agree that selective visibility is a massive problem.
Right. So we need the criteria.
But see, The way you solve selective visibility is not by creating an abstract universal checklist of criteria enforced by a distant authority. You solve it through place.
Through place?
Yes. You solve it by shrinking the distance between the decision and the consequence. This is what Wall calls the territory of consciousness.
Okay, but how does a territory of consciousness prevent a hospital from externalizing care?
Because the territory of consciousness is the lived and symbolic field where people actually know a landscape and each other. When you are rooted in a territory of consciousness, you know the species, you know the microclimates, you know the stories, and you know the people.
So it's about proximity?
It's about deep embeddedness. You can literally see if the river is polluted. You can see if the caregivers in your neighborhood are exhausted because, well, they are your neighbors. Right relationship has to be rooted here, in the dirt, an immediate physical reality, rather than in abstract global policies and criteria.
That is a compelling argument. But have you considered the danger of romanticized localism?
Romanticized localism? I don't think knowing your neighbors is romanticized.
Territory of consciousness sounds beautiful. But if your local community is perfectly regenerative, but the factory two towns over is dumping PFAS into the river you share, your local affection doesn't save your water.
Which is why bioregions have to cooperate. I'm not suggesting isolation.
But cooperation requires structure. Furthermore, localism can easily slide into territorial essentialism, where a community decides that only the authentic locals belong.
I mean, xenophobia is a risk in any system, yes.
But especially in highly localized ones. What happens to the migrant worker? What happens to climate refugees who have no historical tie to that specific territory of consciousness? In an era of climate-related migration, localism can be highly exclusionary, even violently so.
So what's your alternative?
Just a global open-door policy managed by bureaucrats? Place attachment only becomes life coherent when it is permeable. We need permeable belonging, a territorial membership capable of hospitality and change.
And that requires something far more robust than just a shared feeling of local love. It requires what the paper calls nested regenerative governance.
Uh-oh. If you're listening to this and thinking, well, nested regenerative governance just sounds like more government bureaucracy, you wouldn't be entirely wrong to worry about that.
It's not bureaucracy for bureaucracy's sake.
But I am not convinced by this, because it sounds like a trap. Doesn't your nested governance architecture just recreate the Russian nesting doll of centralized bureaucracy?
No, not at all. But think about it. If every local action must be checked against regional, national, and planetary safeguards to ensure it meets your life coherence criterion, haven't we just rebuilt the detached managerialism that separates decision from consequence?
You're assuming a command and control structure.
You're taking the power out of the hands of the bioregion and giving it back to the regional or global managers.
Nested regenerative governance is not a rigid administrative ladder where the global CEO dictates to the local cashier. It is polycentric nested provisioning.
Okay, you're going to have to translate polycentric nested provisioning.
Let me use an analogy to explain the difference. Nested governance is more like the human nervous system. Your hand pulls away from a hot stove autonomously. It has local jurisdiction. It doesn't need to ask permission from the brain to protect itself.
Okay, I follow that.
But if you are running a marathon, your brain is to coordinate the breathing, the heart rate, and the cooling systems across the whole body. Different scales require different authorities.
So the local community is the hand.
Exactly. A local community can govern its own shared spaces, but it cannot claim exclusive authority over a river that flows into three other states or an industry that exports carbon into the planetary atmosphere. The paper uses the concept of island strategic autonomy to explain this brilliantly.
Wait, hold on. You're losing me. You're arguing against isolated localism, but your prime example is an island? An island is literally geographically isolated. How does that prove your point about nested governance?
Because island strategic autonomy proves that autonomy is not autarky.
Meaning self-sufficiency.
Right. Autarky is the illusion of complete closed-loop independence. True strategic autonomy requires diversified interdependence. An island needs local capability? Absolutely. But imagine a devastating hurricane hits that island.
They're going to need help.
You cannot survive a Category 5 hurricane with only local solidarity and a deep connection to the dirt. You desperately rely on regional pooling, emergency reserves, heavy repair capabilities, and diversified external relationships.
Okay, that makes sense.
Nested governance isn't about centralized dictates. It is about making sure that every scale of human activity is supported by and accountable to the scales above and below it. It manages the burdens that are inevitably displaced.
I see the utility in that, especially for transboundary issues like a hurricane or, you know, river pollution. But when we talk about nested governance and defining these territorial jurisdictions, we inevitably run into the question of who actually holds authority at a place.
Well, authority should be democratically and ecologically grounded.
Right. And if we want true regenerative capability, we have to look at how human persons are formed relationally within these places. We learn with place, not just in or about place.
Agreed.
And that means looking organically to local and indigenous knowledge. It is the long-term embedded relationships with land, water, and seasonality that should organically guide our regenerative practice. It shouldn't just be a legalistic framework of jurisdiction. It needs to be a cultural awakening to the wisdom that is already there.
I have to draw a very hard line here.
Oh, on indigenous knowledge?
On how we treat it. The difference between local knowledge and indigenous authority is not just a matter of a cultural awakening. Treating indigenous knowledge merely as ecological data to be included in a broader regenerative project is a form of epistemic extraction.
Meaning we are just harvesting their data to fix our own systems.
Exactly. We cannot just extract traditional ecological knowledge about how to manage a forest, publish it in a journal, and call ourselves regenerative.
Right. That's just colonial science.
The paper is incredibly clear on this. We must move from inclusion to authority. Indigenous knowledge is often inseparable from peoplehood, land, traditional law, and collective consent. It requires data sovereignty.
Meaning they own the data and control its use.
Scientific validation does not grant an institution permission to use that knowledge without authorization. Moving from inclusion to authority is a legal and political necessity, not just a nice cultural sentiment.
So we are talking about actually respecting their legal and political jurisdiction over the land and the knowledge itself. I agree with that.
Good.
But if we are establishing these strict legal jurisdictions, data sovereignty rules, and complex nested governance models, how are everyday people actually supposed to navigate them?
What do you mean?
Doesn't that require a massive leap in human capacity? If everything is bound by these explicit criteria, how does the individual actually operate?
Well, that brings us to a much broader point about human development. Human agency itself isn't just organic and internal to our own brains. It is scaffolded by external structures. Saheli refers to this as the exosomatic matrix.
The exosomatic matrix. Okay, let's break that down, because it sounds like something out of science fiction.
It simply means things outside the physical body that extend our capabilities. It includes tools, writing, archives, legal systems, digital networks, and artificial intelligence.
Like a societal hard drive?
Yes. This matrix functionally extends our cognition and our collective action. Just like a calculator extends your ability to do math, a legal system extends our ability to maintain social contracts across millions of people. We do not operate in a vacuum.
Sure.
Our ability to be regenerative is scaffolded by this vast matrix of technology and law.
But if our agency is completely scaffolded by this exosomatic matrix of technology, AI, and institutional roles, aren't we reducing human beings to mere nodes in a network?
No, I don't think so.
But where does moral accountability reside if the matrix is making the rules and doing the calculating? If a predictive AI or a complex nested legal framework is functionally extending our cognition, it sounds like you are stripping the individual of their dignity and their moral responsibility.
That is a crucial distinction to make. Scaffolding and functional extension do not equal consciousness, nor do they establish independent moral responsibility.
So the matrix doesn't get a pass.
The matrix does not become a moral agent. Accountability always remains with the persons and organizations designing, authorizing, and deploying these systems. You are not just a node, you are a relational person.
But navigating that requires a completely different mindset.
Yes! To exercise that accountability, our entire system of education must fundamentally change.
Because currently, education just teaches us how to operate the machine.
Precisely. We cannot just train institutional subjects who unquestioningly inhabit established roles and use these exosomatic tools blindly. Education must cultivate the capacity to contest these systems.
To push back.
To understand the hidden curriculum within the matrix. And to evaluate who is benefiting and who is bearing the life cost of our technologies.
Which, you know, brings us organically right back to the power of living questions. Education should be about asking how we participate in life's regeneration, not just memorizing the mechanistic rules of the exosomatic matrix or blindly enforcing a life coherence criterion.
Well, the living questions are essential, I'll give you that.
So, to summarize my perspective on this entire transition, life's regeneration must remain a participatory, place-responsive process driven by these living questions. We cannot engineer a living system from the outside.
Even if that system is actively doing harm?
If we try to control this organic, deeply complex transition with rigid criteria, layered bureaucracies, and purely legalistic frameworks, we risk stifling the very local relationality, creativity, and biocultural uniqueness that makes true regeneration possible in the first place. You have to let the community discover its own justice in its own dirt.
And my summary is this. Relationality without explicit normative boundaries is fundamentally blind to power.
Blind to power.
We cannot assume that a localized, resilient process is naturally just. An exploitative system can be deeply local and highly resilient. True transition requires the life coherence criterion to ensure we aren't just adapting to and preserving systems that survive via avoidable disablement elsewhere.
Like the hospital relying on unpaid care.
Or the local town dumping its waste downstream. Without looking critically at accounting boundaries, uncompensated labor, and nested governance, we will simply put a shiny, green, regenerative label on the exact same extractive machine.
I think where we ultimately converge on this debate is that the transition away from extractive dependency is not a simple flip of a switch. There is no single faulty spark plug to replace.
Absolutely not.
It requires concurrent tasks. We have to protect the vulnerable in the immediate term. We have to redirect massive amounts of resources. We have to construct entirely new capabilities. And we have to constantly learn from the living systems we inhabit.
I completely agree. Moving humanity from the historical role of an external manager trying to dominate and fix the world to a reflexive participant deeply embedded within life's regeneration is profoundly complex. Dr. Saley's engagement with Daniel Christian Wall offers an incredibly rich research pathway for unpacking this tension between the organic and the structural.
It really does. It leaves us with so much to explore and so much work to do in our own communities. So as we step away today, we leave it to you, the listener, to decide what true life-coherent practice demands. Are we still treating the world like an engine, just swapping out a spark plug and calling it fixed? Or are we finally ready to understand the soil, the structures, and the living systems that actually sustain us?
Thank you for listening.